I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota, and the topic today is titled Government for Sale, a look at the impact of special interest money on politics and what can be done to reform the system. And this way of background a little bit further on the issue of money in politics, I've spent a significant portion, this certainly not a majority by any means, but a larger amount of time on this issue than most others. I actually chair a committee that deals with campaign finance reform and what we've called, loosely speaking, government ethics laws, and have authored some, I would say, fairly significant legislation that's passed. It wasn't everything I would have hoped for, but legislation banning gifts to public officials from lobbyists and legislation tightening up our campaign finance laws, but feeling there's a long way to go. To start out on the topic, though, if we had to describe what the number one scandal in American politics would be, I would say it's clearly campaign financing. The number one scandal, particularly at the federal level, though to a lesser extent in the states. Minnesota has been described as one of the best states in terms of campaign finance reform. And if we're one of the best, I cringe to think what it's like in other states, and certainly in Washington. It's not always an easy thing to measure, though the public understands it's a problem. When you take polls of people on whether they're going to vote or not, many of those who say they're not going to vote will give as a reason. It doesn't make any difference anyway. The special interest groups control the process. They don't need my vote, it's the money that talks. And once in a while you get a very crude measure of the success of it, and it's hard to point to, but at the national level, the last time there's been a so-called scandal related to money where people actually suffered some consequence, you can certainly get the Lippo group and foreign campaign contributions. You can talk about the soft money things, but the last time there's been somebody who's been nailed for doing something perhaps illegal, the Keating 5 scandal of close to a dozen years ago now. And most of the five U.S. senators involved in the scandal are people who I would think have pretty decent reputations as honorable people. And John Glenn, in retiring, everybody said, well, it was too bad that that colored him a little bit or tainted him a little bit. And you can see how a person with an honorable career who's done good things, you hate to have them marked with this when I'm not sure this is by any means the worst scandal. In that case, a very wealthy bank owner who had, during the SNL crisis, somebody who intervened, he got five U.S. senators to intervene with regulators to try and stop them from shutting down his Lincoln Savings and Loan, and the delay in shutting it down cost taxpayers an estimated $1 billion. And the Savings and Loan scandal, which was many hundreds of billions of dollars in the end, suggests that a little bit of influence in a little bit of way can go a long way to cost the public a lot of money. He gave several thousand dollars in campaign contributions to five different senators. And frankly, if you represent him, if he's from your state or he has ties to your state, and he says, look, you know, here's why I'm concerned about this, talks to somebody's staff person, yes, they will talk to the regulators about it. It doesn't take much to sway something and push it over the edge. How much some of the senators may have been doing it perfectly the way they would with any constituent matter. Some of them may have done it because he was a generous contributor. In the way the interest groups, the way big money tries to drive the process, I'd say there are two things that they're using. The first of which is before elections, second is after elections. Before obviously being campaigns and campaign financing, after being won, campaign contributions for the next election, gifts, and number would be the second one. Gifts aren't always, oh, I'll give you a present of this or cash. It's far more often, at least at state legislative level, it's wining and dining and receptions and other things like that. And then finally, just the total amount spent lobbying. If you spend as this week's Seattle Times said of the $5 million that one side spending in the referendum against the 70,000 in the other side, you get a sense that there's a reason that they spend the $5 million. It's not because Paul Allen doesn't know what to do with his money. He's got enough of it, but nevertheless, he's not giving up $5 million because he can't think of anything better to do. Mm-hmm. He's doing it because he knows it's going to have an impact. And in discussing this whole campaign finance issue, I hate to use the term, or I've been hesitant to use the term corruption. I'm getting a little less hesitant. The reason for the hesitation is that I don't think most of the people involved in politics are crooked. I'd say a very small percentage are, like a very small percentage of the people we represent. There are some dishonest, crooked people in the process, but very few of my colleagues in Minnesota do I think would do anything other than run if they saw somebody try and hand them an envelope full of cash and ask for their vote on something. I think most would run from the process. That's why I hate to use corruption. They don't intend to be corrupt. But nevertheless, even though there's no criminal intent, and even the people giving the money, whether campaign contributions or other means of being generous, they don't intend to buy a vote. I'll give you this if you'll give me your vote. There's no quid pro quo. They are buying access. They are buying goodwill. And the second part of it, they are trying to elect people they agree with. I gave a talk last week about citizen lobbying, how you can make a difference. I suggested two basic areas. One is persuade the people who are in office to take your position, to support your position. Option number two, elect people who share your position in the first place. And that's exactly what they use the money to do. Sometimes we want to use the money to get people who share our concerns into office. Sometimes we want to do it to sway the people in office. Well, isn't that what democracy, what lobbying is all about? Of course it is, but democracy is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the financial interest, by the financial interest, for the financial interest. And so there is a clear distinction, and it is something that, as I said, I think is the number one scandal. Let me give you a couple of examples. The first time I saw how this thing really works as an insider was after winning my first election. It was not one I was supposed to win. I was considered a long shot, and I know the day after the election, both the two biggest Twin City newspapers had a front page or page three story about how I pulled off such an upset. So it was an upset, and about 2 days, 3 days after the election, I got a really nice note from a lobbyist who is a nice guy and decent person. A contract lobbyist represents several different organizations or groups or causes. And he sent me a letter and a $400 check with a note. The letter was very nice. I saved the letter because it says it so well, and I think a lot of people wouldn't believe it if they didn't see it. But, dear John, congratulations on your election. I can say it almost word for word 10, 11 years later. You showed that hard work really does pay off. One of my clients, and it's an honorable, it's part of the medical profession, one of my clients had the misfortune of having contributed to your opponent. Here's a contribution as they wish to make amends. Well, he's more blunt than a lot of others were, which is why I saved the letter. Well,
did he underline the words pay off in the first
place? That was unstated. But why, what was the misfortune? First of all, why did they give my opponent money? My opponent...
Was he an incumbent?
What was he?
Incumbent.
No, he was not an incumbent. He was an incumbent city council member in more than half the district. It was a sort of an evenly split Democratic or DFL in Minnesota, DFL Republican district. One half... Half I live in is heavily Republican, and the half he lived in was heavily DFL, and he had won by a landslide for city council in that half, and therefore he was easily going to win my half, and he was going to win the election. But why did they give him money? The group, nothing sinister about the group, it was ophthalmologists, the eye doctors, and they had one big issue in Minnesota that lasted over a decade, and it was, what can optometrists do versus what ophthalmologists do? And it was kind of a, we're trying to protect the public health by making sure only medical physicians who deal with eyes can have control, and the optometrists are saying, look, you know, they're just fencing us out so they can make more money, and it's a consumer protection thing that you don't give them their way. Anyway, that was their one issue. They didn't know where I stood on the issue. They never asked me, that I recall. I doubt they asked him where he stood on the issue. So they weren't out for supporting him because they thought he'd be the best state senator for the state or for our district or even for their industry. Likewise, they didn't go against me because they thought I would be the worst for it. They were giving money to him because he was supposed to win. They made an investment. They blew it. So now I was the one in office, and all of a sudden they had to make amends to me. That was one example, and I thought it was a pretty blatant one, and I thought an interesting one. The next one is one, an individual I met here at Holden Village about 6 years ago, a wonderful guy. He was marginally involved in politics, and a year later, we had a number of good talks, and a year later he decided to run for state senate. He lost. Last year he won in a state house race, and in Minnesota, Dave's a state representative here, and we were talking about spending in our campaigns. We've got spending limits to deal with this as part of our campaign finance reform, and they're reasonably tight. If they're too tight, it helps incumbents because the challenger doesn't have a way to get their word out. If they're too loose, it helps incumbents because challengers tend not to be able to raise that much money, so the trick is to get them the right amount and inflation adjust them. But our spending limits in Minnesota House districts, which are smaller than the ones here, is about $22,000, $23,000, $24,000. And in rural Minnesota, a lot of candidates have great trouble, non-incumbents have great trouble raising that kind of money. Even with our public financing thing, most of them who are aggressive candidates who are working hard for it will raise the limit. And I'll make the assumption that this individual who I met here raised the $23,000, $24,000 he was able to spend, that he raised and spent that in the campaign. The last 10 days of the election, no clue until then, the last 10 days of the election, a group called Coalition for Minnesota Business spent approximately $10,000, $11,000 in what they call independent expenditures in his race, telling people of his district that he doesn't care about them. But this group of Coalition for Minnesota Businesses, they have to file their campaign finance report. I think the average size of their donation was about $750, because they seem to be about half $1,000 givers, half $500 givers. Every name on the list was downtown Minneapolis or St. Paul business people who live in the suburbs, but their businesses are downtown St. Paul, Minneapolis. This was a Western Minnesota district. Not a single person contributing to this group who was telling the people who to vote for lived in the district. Yet they ran ad after ad in the newspapers, mailings, all of it designed to hit in the last minute, when in our local races you can't do much. I don't know that he had good radio stations that would hit mainly his district. So he had not much chance to respond. And if he and his opponent both spend the same $20,000, and then this outside group, and there were two outside groups that came in, both against him, they spend $10,000, maybe $5,000 each. That's $15,000 on top of his opponent's spending in order to sway the election. Now, what logical reason do we want in a democracy to have the person who's supposed to represent those communities in Western Minnesota determined by interest groups that have not a penny coming from people in the district? Even if it was a group where one guy would give $30,000 to it, who lives in the district, and say, okay, let's spend $30,000 to buy the election here. Is that the way we want to do things? I suggest that's part of the problem. Then, in terms of getting away from campaign finance for a minute, until the gift ban legislation I carried passed, one lobbyist, they did have to report, they found ways to sort of not itemize anything, but they had to report how much they spent on disbursements on behalf of food, entertainment, and that sort of category. One lobbyist spent $118,000 over a 2.5-year period. That's a lot of food and beverages. Matter of fact, a former staff person of mine once worked for our assistant majority leader, and while she was working for him, one of their committee clerks or pages or interns or somebody who was there just during our legislative session came, commented to her once, who is that caterer? Because every day he'd bring in bagels or donuts into all the office suites. He just set them down. Oh yeah, here we got some blueberry bagels today, or whatever. She said, who's that caterer? Well, he's a lobbyist, a powerful lobbyist. He's very heavy set, and I'm sure he ate a lot of the expenditure, but he couldn't have eaten that much. And if you figure out that the whole lot of us didn't get anything from him, and freshmen get nothing from people like that usually, some people were taking good advantage of being well-fed and well-entertained by him. And the caterer, I thought that was a good description for a lobbyist. Yeah, that was his task. And another lobbyist who happens to be a big donor, campaign donor, and on top of that, he would share with many ways. He represented the Minnesota Vikings. His law firm, or his lobbying firm, represented the Vikings, and their payment, or at least part of their payment from the Vikings, was that they'd get some of these luxury suites that are not being used for certain games. And then you just bring key public officials in, they get the box suites and have wonderful meals. It was interesting because our law required them to itemize any contribution, any gift over $50 to somebody. You know, if you have a legislator and spouse go in to these things, the tickets to Vikings games, I think $40 or so, and the box suites, it would be many times that, and the meal and this and everything else they'd bring into it. How didn't they do that? Well, he found a loophole in the law, so he never had to report any of that. Well, why was he bringing you to Vikings games? You could learn what the Vikings' concerns were facing state government. I didn't know the Vikings had any back then, but now they're asking for $160 million from the state. And his contributions weren't attributed to, his gifts weren't attributable to the Vikings, nor to the tobacco industry, who he also represents, nor to any of 10 other clients. They were just him being a friend. My first year in the legislature, the Twins were in the World Series. One lobbyist I didn't even know offered me a ticket. It wasn't because he wanted to sit next to me and talk about whatever his client's concern was. In the Twin Cities, when the Twins were in the World Series, you couldn't hear the Metrodome. They had dangerous noise levels. He didn't want to talk to me about anything. He wanted to be my friend. He didn't know me any better than he knew my next door neighbor, which is not at all. Yet I got the offer for the ticket. If I was not a freshman, I might have gotten two tickets offered to me. But those are the ways they put the money in. And when you look at the lobbyists who are most successful, it's not because they're the most articulate. Matter of fact, that guy who represents the Vikings and all those interests, and the one who gave the caterer, neither of them are very articulate individuals. I would say they're the opposite of articulate. They're not well informed on many issues. They understand the political process. And everybody knows them, and they're very generous. And when one of the two of them, one of them was a Democratic state delegate at the year I was running for governor, and he was quoted in the newspaper saying he was going to the convention first time in 10 years, not because of who he supported, but because of who he opposed. And I thought, well, he didn't say who, and then later in the article it became pretty clear. But afterwards, in the general election campaign after the primary, he hosted a fundraiser for my opponent, and I was not surprised. I knew he wasn't going to support me. But when a Democratic state party delegate, state convention delegate, hosts fundraiser for the Republicans, you'd think somebody in our party leadership would say something. And so our campaign organization was pressing some legislative leaders to at least say that, you know, this guy's not much of a Democrat or something. And one of them told him, no, we can't say anything against him. He's too important. Why is he too important? He gives a lot of money. So I hope there's a coloring of why I think it's so bad. Well, what do we do about it? Well, first of all, one more point about the size of gifts. Obviously, if somebody gives you $1,000, it's going to have more impact than if they give you a smaller amount of money. And yet even, I think in a discussion yesterday, I was talking about how I think even small favors, not so much in campaign contributions, but at least in terms of gifts, even small things make a difference. And the best example I can point to, and it's introductory psychology kind of course example, the Hare Krishna people at the airport who would used to give you religious tracts or more often flowers, and the flowers may be worth a few cents each. They give you a carnation and you refuse it, and they push it on you and they insist you take it. It's my gift. And okay, I'll take your gift and leave. And would you be willing to help out our cause? And despite the fact that they'd asked for $5, $10, you might only give them $1, $2, $3, but nevertheless, you didn't want their flower. They forced it on you, and yet you somehow felt obligated to return it. They were very successful. The only reason they're not in the airports now is most airports have found ways to ban them, and ban any sort of solicitation or other sorts of things so that people can't do that. But human nature is such that you're nice to me, I'm going to be nice to you. And politics is about the only field where we make the assumption that, as one U.S. congressman said several years ago, this is the only field where we're expected to be total ingrates. You give us something and we're not going to be grateful in the least. We're not going to even notice that you gave us $1,000. We're going to pay no attention to it. And that's not human nature. And it does, I suggest that our biggest scandal can be broken only if we break the link between money and politics. How do you try it? Well, before I get to the obstacles, I'll tell you there are a couple of things you can do. First of all, in terms of lobbying expenses, maybe the only thing you can do there is disclosure. Find out how much is being spent. I tried several years ago to make a requirement in Minnesota that you have to disclose how much money you as an interest group are going to spend on lobbying, or you spent on lobbying in the past 6-month period or whatever. And, oh, that would be so burdensome. I don't know how we could calculate that. And, you know, oh, this is very difficult to do. And some of us do legal work for our clients as well as that. And how do we know? And I thought every corporation has people estimate how much of their time they spend on certain projects, and time allocation is not that difficult of a science. But, oh, this is so difficult, we can't do that. So how about ranges? So one of my colleagues said, John, you should be happy. We'll put it in there, but we'll do it in the form of ranges. Well, in Minnesota, you're not registered as a lobbyist unless you put out more than $500 in a year, so nothing under $500 is reported. But the first range they did, so they could round off their numbers or whatever, was $500 to $50,000. They decided they didn't want to do it, and so they could do this and say, now we've got disclosure. And every time I've tried to tighten that up, no, we can't tighten that up because we already have disclosure. We don't want to get nitpickier than that. But the disclosure is always a first step. And you could argue, some people would argue, the only thing we have to do in campaign financing is disclose everything. It'll all be up front. Well, there are thousands of issues out there. The world's too complex. People don't pay enough attention. And we're supposed to make a stink about who's giving money, who's funding the campaigns. There are certain things that we ought to limit. I think Minnesota, which is 40 years behind Wisconsin, the first state in the country to do it, banning gifts made some sense. I was going to leave little gaps in it for ordinary office hospitality. If you come to my office and I'm thinking ahead and being polite, I'll offer you a cup of coffee. If I go to yours and you're a lobbyist and you offer me a cup of coffee, I was going to allow minor exceptions like that. But it was very tightly written because I wrote the thing. And on the Senate floor, somebody decided, oh, they were going to show me how tough they could be. They were going to ban even that. And so the amendment, I said, you know, I don't care if you want to ban all that. It might be a little more awkward in a few situations, but if you want to do that, fine with me. I'll support it. And it passed overwhelmingly, the amendment to ban it totally. And they knew it would die in the House, but the House kind of got scared because it was an election year. And so they voted for it too, and it passed almost unanimously in both houses. If I took a private poll of how many thought this was a good idea or something they'd support, I don't think there were 5 members of the Senate or 5 in the House who would say they support it. Not 5. Yet it passed almost unanimously in the Senate. Why? Well, they were scared to vote against it. they realize it doesn't look good. And now every now and then they try and ridicule it. Oh, some guy was the best man in his friend's wedding, a lobbyist in a public official's wedding was best man. And, oh, he couldn't even give a wedding gift. And he asked our ethical practices board if he was allowed to. And he tried to portray it. He was trying to ridicule the law. He had no intention of abiding by it. And if he did it quietly, nobody would have known. You could argue he got things in exchange for it, so it wasn't really a gift. And he could have found lots of ways around it, or he would have just done it privately, because I don't know anyone who'd try and prosecute a friend for doing it for a friend. But he was trying to make a point. And then after he did, he had all these radio and TV interviews. And then he said, well, I'm going to give it anyway. And if they're going to try and prosecute him, let them lock me up. But nobody had said anything about it. He could have done it. He could have found ways to do it if he really insisted on doing it. And it does make awkward social settings. But it's not such a crisis that we can't address it. We've lived with it for 3 years, and despite a lot of grumbling internally at the Capitol, it's known as the such and such Marty Law. Expletive Marty Law. Public, unfortunately, calls it the gift ban law, so I don't get the credit where people like it. I do get the blame where they hate it. But I think that finding ways to realistically ban the gifts, the travel, everything else, is worth doing. And it's going to be a fight for several years yet to keep it from getting weakened. You'd be amazed how many things. One legislator says, oh, I do this this golf tournament to raise funds for the University of Minnesota. And well, all I want is lobbyists to be able to give gifts, prizes for the golf tournament. Well, why don't they just give the prizes to the University of Minnesota? Well, because he wants to do it this way. It's a big social gathering and big fun event, and it's their little loopholes. Oh, they have to change it for the national conventions. Because the national conventions, how do you control it? All of these groups are funding all of these things. And we gotta have a loophole for that. Well, in any case, we can't change the national rules, and so it may be awkward to the people attending the conventions. Congress even recognized that after the ITT scandal of early 70s. They actually put public financing in for national conventions. We as taxpayers pay for them. And that's a great thing if we took the special interest money out of it. All they did was put money into it, and they didn't limit anything else. Every phone paid for it, both the national Democratic and Republican conventions, every cell phone, every everything paid for by AT&T or MCI. I mean, they just gave it all to them. It's the biggest party you can get to. You get some of the most powerful leaders in the country from each party together for a week, and you see who can be most extravagant in being generous to them. So they want loopholes for that and everything else, and it's a continual struggle, but banning gifts is an important part. Then finally, public financing. My goal was to take the big money out and replace it with public financing, small contributions. I wanted nothing over $100, no, not a penny from lobbyists, not a penny from political action committees, and more and fairer distribution of public financing. I thought that made a lot of sense. I've run my campaigns that way. It hasn't been the reason I've lost the one race I lost. And it wasn't the reason I've won races either, but I think it's the right way to go. The trouble is, and now we get to the obstacles. The courts don't have any problem with limiting gifts from lobbyists or interest groups to public officials. They have big problems, the U.S. Supreme Court, with First Amendment and limiting free speech. And so of the two obstacles, the courts and the difficulty of passing such things, I'll get to the court one first. And the courts have said very clearly that it is the First Amendment, is the First Amendment for a reason. It's very important. And you have to have very pressing, urgent reasons to infringe on it in even minor ways. In 1976, the so-called Buckley-Vallejo decision, Supreme Court threw out most spending limits. They allowed some modest contribution limits because of the, quote, appearance of corruption. And I can tell you, and I think the public understands the role money plays in politics, the Supreme Court says you have to prove it. And we've never bothered to try and prove it. We've always felt, well, this is the problem. I'm going to come in here with a bill that takes care of these concerns. And the court says, well, you didn't show us why what the problem is. And I don't think the court misreads the First Amendment. I think they misread, they failed to read the Equal Protection Amendment, the concern that everybody deserves equal protection under our Constitution. And whereas in other areas where you have fundamental constitutional rights, right to legal counsel and other things, if you're unable to afford them, we provide a way to afford it. But we don't do it for campaign financing. If I can afford 30, or some interest group can afford TV commercials in the stadium issue, if one side can afford 30-second spots, three of them on every primetime show for the last 2 weeks in Seattle, and the other side can't afford a single TV spot, well, we cannot infringe on his free speech, right? But the other side, well, sorry, their fundamental right, they don't get it because they can't afford it. So I think the courts have missed that, and they're also misreading. Their concern is that we have a more vibrant debate, and they say the way to limit, the way to have a more vibrant debate isn't to limit one side, it's to help the other side. Well, maybe and maybe not. Given the way interests are in the political process, it's not always one well-funded interest against another well-funded interest butting heads. It's much more often on tax policy. It's one particular interest group against the public at large, the taxpayer at large, the consumer at large. And the other side is not organized because it's too small of an issue for any one person. Maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in tax break for somebody, but nobody else, it's a little bit out of each person's pocket. So I think we have to try and document to the courts what the problem is. They're misreading the fact that many issues never are heard in our system because they don't have the money. They get shut out quickly. We have to document the problems, and we have to point out the things that they're missing in terms of their interpretation of those problems. The second thing I think we have to do, and that's what we've tried to do in Minnesota, is creative ways around it. They say you cannot mandate spending limits. They have so far upheld or refused to overturn lower court rulings upholding Minnesota's campaign finance laws, which basically say you can have voluntary limits. And how do we make voluntary ones have any impact? We give a very heavy incentive. You get public finance money if you agree to the limit. If you don't agree to the limit, not only does your opponent get the public financing, but they're also freed from the limits. You give them a big head start in their fundraising. So we have almost universal compliance with it, but then you get the independent expenditures. As these groups find out we want to have the clout, we can't give it to campaigns, we will give it as independent expenditures. Some groups that give mainly to the Democratic Party, some that do mainly the Republican Party, have found out how to do this very well. And I mentioned the case earlier of legislative, a group where in a $20,000 race, they put $10,000 in. Well, that's one where you have to find creative ways. You listen to what the courts say, you try and find creative ways around that, and I do think there are some, and we're exploring some of this coming 6 months in the interim. But the two solutions, the two options short of a constitutional amendment are find creative ways to address the court's concerns, and number two, be more upfront about what the problem is. Let's document it. Let's prove our case to the courts on why there's a problem. And it's a hard thing to persuade colleagues of the importance of doing that because they don't see it as a problem. They think the public is just concerned. I can't be bought. I've heard so many colleagues say, I can't be bought for $500. If you can, that's your problem, not mine. Well, the public sees what's happening. Public sees it clearly, and I think those of us who do in legislatures feel like you have to make the point to them that there's something other than buying votes, that buying access and goodwill is a problem as well, and we have to address that. But then, because of that, it makes it a harder process to persuade colleagues of. when I first tried carrying some of these things a number of years ago, what's the problem? Again, the gifts, the $50, the giving gifts to public officials. Well, I take offense that you accuse me of being bought for that. And yet, even the reporters at the Capitol, our state Capitol press corps, they have offices in the Capitol. They're regulars there. Most of them have been covering it for 5 or 10 years. And they don't see anything shocking. Last year on the stadium financing thing during the campaign, I tried to document how much the owners and the lobbyists for the Minnesota Twins were contributing, not to the political process, but to both parties at the same time. Not, I don't mean candidates of both parties. That wasn't, lots of people give money to candidates. Lots of people give money to one party. Very, very, very few people, namely lobbyists and interest groups, give money to both political parties. Our Senate and House Democratic caucuses and the Republican House and Senate caucuses both got about $17,000 from the owner of the Minnesota Twins last year. Their lobbyists, when asked why they were given to both sides, we don't see this as a partisan issue. Well, the public at large says, why would you give money to both parties? It doesn't make any sense. And they say, well, we just want to be players. Well, what do they mean by that? Well, we want to have access. The courts, we have to prove that to them, against the will of legislators who don't see a problem and public who does see the problem. Again, the difficulty of passing, the only way I see around that is, first of all, some states have initiative processes, but that's very difficult because people find ways to have bad ones. They tilt it one way or another. We're going to make it a partisan thing. We're going to help our cause by limiting the other party or the other side's access to funds and not limiting our own. We're going to make them the scandal and not a bipartisan fair manner. And so initiative process is not my favorite means for dealing with it. What I think has worked best is trying to get public outrage. The year we passed our gift ban and our campaign finance bills in 93 and 94, it was basically because there were totally unrelated scandals to what we were talking about here. It was not money-related scandals. There was one with misuse of state phones and a big scandal related to that that resulted in one legislator resigning and some other things. That created public outrage and enough sympathy to change. And the media paid attention. Every time in 93 when I did the campaign finance reform, the Ross Perot groupies who were active after 92, they'd all come in sitting there. They decided they liked my bill, which I appreciate. They'd sit there every day. People had never been involved in politics. There were 10, 20 citizens every day the bill was up. We spent every day of hearings in the entire session on my bill from the first week of session to the last committee deadline date to get the bill out of my committee. I chaired the committee, and they didn't. It's never a bill was spent half as many hearings as that bill did. Why? They weren't sure how to kill it, and they didn't want to vote it down, and they certainly didn't want to pass it. And so we just had playing games for weeks. And every time they were about ready to strip an amendment out, it was funny, the reporters who have these sound system down in their offices so they can hear what's going on in the hearing rooms, as soon as somebody'd make a motion to take some section of the bill out, they'd all come running up there, a few of them sit down in the room, and all of a sudden the will to take it out dropped. It was a cat and mouse game, and the reporters were very clear what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing. Nobody said anything, but it was obvious. And it was because of the public pressure, day in and day out, it was generated by the media paying attention, that it passed. And like with the gift ban bill, the campaign finance thing, if you asked how many members of either party supported it, it was nowhere close to a majority. And in my own caucus, I had, it was about once a year, maybe twice a year, a beat up on John Marty session, closed door caucus, and everybody can say, why are we doing this dumb stuff, and all kinds of insults. But they voted for it despite their opposition to it because of the public pressure. So I think there are ways around it, and I talked a lot more than I wanted to, so I'll shut up quickly so we can have some more discussion over this. And we have a state representative from Washington here who lives under lack of campaign finance rules and has, we talked about some of these issues yesterday. But
when you have disclosure laws, how many lobbyists have been prosecuted for not disclosing? Is this an honor system, or you know, there's so many ways that you can give gifts to influence something. I'm just wondering how effective enforcement of such provision is.
Okay. There have been no prosecutions for failure to disclose. Our Ethical Practices Board, which we renamed this year because people didn't want to be under investigation by the Ethical Practices Board. It sounded too bad. So they changed the name of it. And that was probably wise because it's not an Ethical Practices Board. It's basically a library of disclosure documents. They don't do anything else. And I've been trying to push because they could do more, but they don't. They have civil authority and they collect, they charge fines for late reporting, failure to report, and people routinely get minor fines and okay, they mediate it out and they sometimes pay a reduced fine or whatever, and then they're forced to disclose. But the board is arbitrarily, like, and this is not just for lobbyists, this is campaigns for everyone. Candidates, any contribution over $100, you must disclose not only the name, but the occupation of the person giving it to you. It says, the law says you shall disclose the name and the occupation, or if self-employed, the occupation, or otherwise the employer. You have to disclose that. But some group came and pointed out that the governor for the last several years has been disclosing less than half of the occupations. And the board had never gone after anyone for failing to do that because they made an arbitrary decision. If you disclosed at least half of them, you were making a good faith effort to do it. The law didn't say that. They made the decision. And so this group found out, yes, last year the governor disclosed only about 40% of the occupations. And they pursued that, and the same day the governor appoints all the members of the board, and the same day they were hearing his case, he sent a 5-page letter saying how dumb our campaign finance laws were, how we shouldn't have to disclose anything under $5,000 when you can't even give legislators more than $500 anymore. he was going to withdraw all of our limits and just say you shouldn't disclose anything. And it was intrusive to ask what somebody's occupation or employer was. And so he was basically telling them that these are stupid laws and I, the guy who appointed you, think this is that. They decided that they would try and enforce it more rigorously in the future. They were not going to go back and ask him to dig him out. He said he couldn't do it. So one of the bills I was trying this year was to simply say, if you do not provide the name of the occupation employer, you shall return the contribution. You can't accept anonymous contributions. If you know who it came from, all you do is you send it back saying, I can't accept this till you tell me who your occupation or employer was. But so we've got problems with the enforcement of that with candidates. Are there cheating? I've been told all sorts of things like how pull tabs at the hotel that lobbyists and legislators hang out at during session, you'll get three lobbyists and a legislator there and they'll all pitch in $5 to buy pull tabs. And, oh, here's the winner. I think that was yours, Representative so-and-so. one lobbyist was telling me about this and how they will, I'll flip you for dinner. Oops, you lost. Well, how about 2 out of 3 until you win? And the lobbyist was telling this to a big public forum on a panel discussion on this issue we had. And I told the lobbyist, I mean, he was trying to ridicule it. I said, first of all, we don't usually repeal laws because people violate them. We usually try and enforce them. And second of all, if there's a single lobbyist who sees a single case of this and they go public with it, it won't happen again. Basically, because he's talking tough about, he knows this all happens. I was trying to put him on the spot because there were reporters in the room that, look, if you see this happening just once and you'll name names, these guys will, they'll be out of politics. I'll guarantee it will end careers to have people cheating publicly about how they get gifts from lobbyists. You'll put people out of office. And I said, it would only take one lobbyist one time to do it and you'll stop the practice. Is there cheating? I'm sure there's some. Frankly, as I said earlier, I think most, I'll say 95% or so of politicians are not going to break the law. They're not going to play those games. They're scared silly about getting exposed in the media for doing something that may just look wrong, something that they know is wrong. I think very few will. And yeah, they're going to be those cheaters and they'll be there with or without the laws. So I'd say, first of all, you go after those cases, but that's not the biggest problem. Other perspectives from We talked a lot about this yesterday.
You said there were no campaign spending limits. That's true, but we do have contribution limits, $150 per individual and $550 for PACs, and I think $50 gift, isn't it, Chair?
So you have, your contribution limits are tighter than ours then, because ours are $500 a person. And I think I may have mentioned you yesterday when Minnesota was one of the first.
That's what ours are, $550.
From a group, though?
From a person, too.
Oh, okay.
Each election, primary and general in the same year are called an election. So
okay.
$550.
Yeah, ours is $500, so it's about the same there. But in post-Watergate, when there was the first attempt to regulate campaign, bizarre reason, had gubernatorial candidates allowed to accept $60,000. And per person, per couple, it was $120,000. And there really were people who gave $120,000. They weren't doing it because they were generous people. They were doing it because most of them had interests and wanted to contribute nicely.
It's hard to know. You know, I'm wrestling with that right now, whether I should take PAC money if I run again. Theoretically, it doesn't influence me. Frankly, I don't even know who gave to me. I know a few labor unions did, and I do know that four insurance companies did. I took one vote last session. I really don't know if that influenced me. I didn't think it did at the time, but there's no way you can know, really.
You can't know.
Psychoanalyze yourself. It's impossible.
And the trouble, too, with the appearance of it then, because this year I was trying to at least get the disclosure of lobbyist contributions of any amount. And one of my colleagues on the committee said, well, she was really bothered by that, because if she took $100 from somebody and it had to be disclosed, and then she voted for something that they were sympathetic to and she really believed in it, well, then they might think she was being bought. And I thought, well, so the solution to the problem is don't tell anyone what's happening, and then if you are or aren't, you can't defend it, which is why I'd much rather we ban the lobbyist contribution. But again, I wouldn't want to. The first race I ran, I fully complied with the limits of the law, and I took contributions up to the limits of the law. Didn't get that many big ones, but I also know if I ever agreed with the groups that gave money, and I certainly did in some of the cases, you feel, oh boy, are people going to think the wrong thing? So I feel a lot more comfortable since I've been able to. And again, because we have public financing and because we have lower limits, it made it a lot different than your situation. I, running for U.S. House or Senate, is a totally different world, because it's like what you have. There are no limits. And the other side's going to outspend you if you impose yourself limits.
I think it's much, much, much worse at the federal level. There's no question you can't get elected unless you raise big money, and you better vote the way that money came in, or you're not going to go back the next time. I mean, you can't do it. It's impossible. Nearly impossible. Yeah. There's a few people like Senator Kerry and some of those who are able to raise enough nationally. But geez, a few more of them are trying that too, and you're getting a ton of these letters now, aren't we? Didn't that guy that ran against the guy we hate from North Carolina?
Yeah, Harvey Gantt, yeah. Well, all those cases, Bill Bradley, I never heard him once talk about campaign finance reform. He got out of office and he said, it's the number one scandal in politics. Mm-hmm. Paul Simon from Illinois, he said one of the reasons he didn't run again was because he knew the minimum he could run a competitive campaign in Illinois was $6 million. He said, okay, that's a six-year term. The day after he was elected, he starts raising money. That's $1 million a year divided by 50 weeks. If he wants 2 weeks off for fundraising, he's got to raise $20,000 a week for 6 years. That's a lot of money. One of Minnesota's congressmen was profiled in U.S. News, and he's big media hawk who's always trying to get the media, and I think he was thrilled he was getting the national story, but it was about his fundraising in U.S. News and World Report, and it talked about how every day he speed walks from the Capitol to campaign offices a few blocks away and spends an hour or two dialing for dollars. And he's very good at getting 500 there and 1,000 there, and he does it week after week, and he's one of the two or three biggest war chests in Minnesota congressional races, and may win because of that. He's good at calling people and asking for money. But you had a...
Well, this is probably the most naive suggestion you could imagine because it sounds so simple, but if in fact the people who give the money say they're not trying to buy anything, and if in fact the people who accept the money say it doesn't influence us, what would be wrong with letting people give any amount they want, but it goes through a broker
anonymously
who takes the names off and says, here's how much you got from somebody, here's how much you got from the other side, and they could donate any money they wanted.
I always thought anonymous contributions would be an interesting way to do it because it would certainly take out the currying favor part, because you could not curry favor if nobody could know. Of course, unless some of these guys would find a way to make sure they knew that we gave you that.
Oh, but, well, wait a minute.
Yeah, but you could
answer to that one too.
Yeah.
You go up and tell John that you gave him $50,000,
and you can tell me.
I
can
tell
thing.
You the same thing.
And the one that doesn't take care of is the fact that interest groups, the other purpose for doing it is not just to curry favor, but the other purpose is to get people you want elected. And for the people who, since a lot of these lobbyists, as I pointed out, give money to both parties, hey, they want to help grease the political system, so then they could, why don't we just take the money and divide it equally among all the candidates? If you want to help foster debate here, do it that way. Obviously, the courts wouldn't allow that, but I think the anonymous thing, I've often wondered if there's a way you could tie that in somehow. I'm not sure exactly how you could do it that would address the second concern, but the other thing is, given the court thing, if we could find a way to require not just a little disclaimer at the bottom in 5-point typeface that you can hardly read, and on TV commercials for this long, if you require a commercial to have a full 5 seconds, this was paid for by, and not the name of the PAC, which sounds like Minnesota Freedom, Political Freedom Fund, or Coalition for Minnesota's Future, or all these wonderful sounding things, but this is paid for by someone so-and-so multi-millionaire, I mean, explain who's the funding behind the thing. If you really did some of that, you'd have a, you could begin getting it there, but I don't think, I mean, I'm not sure that the anonymous ones, that it would, that you could do it in a way that would address a lot of the real problems, but it's certainly a good illustration of why they're doing it. Nobody'd be willing to. With the gift ban stuff, I've been able to use that. These groups, our League of Cities and our Association of Counties, they say, look at our conventions. Some of these groups, these bond houses, they provide funding for our state convention every year. And they'll provide a dinner and reception and this and that. And your bill, Marty, you're making it so the taxpayers have to pay all those costs for that. And I said, they are paying the cost for that. And I said, well, if you want to do it this way, why don't we have it that anyone who wants can anonymously contribute to these groups, and then they can use that funds along with the funds that they get from the cities or counties, and they can have the convention. Well, why would anyone want to do that? We don't get the credit for it. And you're right, the bond houses that have the best connections with the city council members, they're the ones that are hired for the bonding projects. They're the ones who get it that way, but... Yes.
With the whole Paul Allen Stadium issue here in Washington, I think a thing that's different and even more corrupt than what's sort of the run-of-the-mill corruption is that he is paying for the cost of the election. And I'm wondering, are the Vikings or the Twins proposing that in Minnesota?
We don't have an election. We don't have initiative here, so they're not. They are. It's interesting because the whole reason the taxpayers have to kick in the money is because they can't afford to do it. Well, yeah, the paper says he spent like $2.5 million to lobby it through the legislature, plus $4-some million for the election, plus $5 million on the election. I was trying to suggest that the poll ads, the much poorer guy in Minnesota who owns the Twins, he's a billionaire and a half maybe, and I guess Paul Allen dwarfs that, but he spent, I know he spent a couple million on lobbying it. They've got a couple million in TV commercials, and...
Well, he made enough in 1 week on his Microsoft stock to build both stadiums.
In Seattle.
Yeah. Seattle, yeah. Our guy was just...
I didn't hear that.
Paul Allen make as much money in 1 week on Microsoft sale as stock option stuff.
The stock went up so much that he could build both. He were pointing that out. Mm-hmm. He made so much last week, he could build both stadiums.
And out here there's in the, your nice booklets, which I actually think other states would be wise to copy your election booklets, in terms of giving each side... give a candidate a chance to do it. It may not be a lot if you give somebody 1,000 words or something to explain why you should vote for them or their cause or whatever, and the other side a chance to give their 1,000 words and then rebut the other side's things. That's actually a very helpful way for voters to get information. And California has it, you have it, several other states do. But I think that's very helpful. I thought the interesting thing was the rebuttal of the Paul Allen opponents in this case. They focused on one thing, and that is, look, you know, what we need is a chance to have a public debate on this. He won't debate us. He just keeps running the commercials. And you're right. I've never heard of a private party financing an election. It's, if you want to talk about government for sale, it's right. It sure looks to me like it. But I don't know what people are predicting what the poll will say on it, but I picture have trouble
probably
losing. Yeah, that's what I picture.
When you most people that don't even really care about sports, they just say, "Well, it's not going to cost us anything, so why not?" Because that's the mentality. That's what's been pushed so much. And everybody I've talked to thinks that.
And if you could get it down clear, I mean, if you could get the real issue down, let Paul Allen build a new stadium, and if it's going to cost him $400 million. Or whatever it's going to cost. Here, we as taxpayers decide that we think it's worth this much to have the Seahawks in town, and therefore we will write out a check to Paul Allen for $400 million. And then we can do any of these taxes, any of these fees, any of these other things that we're doing now. If you separate the two issues, the stadium from us writing a subsidy for a team, it makes it a little more obvious. And in Minnesota, every single commercial I've seen, and I haven't seen that many, but I've seen about 3 different types, every one of them is how wonderful outdoor baseball would be, because the Metrodome's a lousy place for baseball and so on. And so I offered my own, because people were saying, oh, you're just anti-stadium, anti-this. I said, no, I would like an outdoor baseball stadium. I don't go to a lot of games, but when I do, I'd rather be outside. So I offered a private financing package. Pay for it with the new revenues from the stadium. Poll ads would still have an extra $5 million a year or so over what they have now in the current one, after you pay off the bonds of the new thing. Just because it generates so much new revenue with the naming rights and the luxury suites and everything else. So make it self-financing, and that fully addresses their concern, their most obvious concern, about new stadium, and it only partially, as I said, addresses their other concern, namely, we want money. And the poll ads, of course, they'd never accept that. But then I say, well, if it doesn't work, and if they need more money from the state, let's just ask how much we should write out a check for them, if we should write out a check, and if so, for how many millions. And I think the public would say no, but you tie these issues together, you make it complex, it's free money. And that's what people really get to believe, so.
Well, what it gets down to in Washington is a subsidy of $50 per ticket per game for the next 20 years.
That's how much it would be?
That's what it adds up to.
Ticket tax, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
That's what some have suggested.
500% ticket tax.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think your proposal, though, maybe in jest, would make, economically make a lot more sense if we just took the $400 million and invested it, you know, and said you get the 10% return or whatever, and then at the end of 20 years when they're going to say this stadium is, you know, no longer state of the art, at least we'd still have the $4 million in capital sitting in the bank account.
And it's, but they don't want it. The whole purpose for tying it with stadiums, because it's not that you can't play football in quote, obsolete stadiums, it's that they don't generate the revenue they need because they're paying, it's an economic subsidy that's been going on for enough that it's the system's out of control. And the only way to stop it is to say no, and because it's a cartel with limited teams for more markets, they can pit one community against another, and they've got everyone on the run. And if Seattle says no today, and if Washington says no today, and if Minnesota can say no, we're going to have a special session on it apparently in September. If we can say no, it may start turning the tide, and the leagues at some point, we'll hope our national representatives in Washington put the pressure, because they could change the rules and say, they could hammer them under antitrust things. There are lots of ways.
Moynihan's proposal
is a good start.
You know, ban tax-free bonds for private football stadiums was a good start.
Yeah. And one Minnesota Federal Reserve Bank vice president has suggested what you do is you either ban taxpayer subsidies for businesses of this sort, or you tax them at 100% at the federal level, and basically you take away all the incentive to do it. Because if St. Louis can't do it, and Minnesota can't do it, then Washington doesn't have to do it. If nobody else can do it, you do it. And he said, well, why should the federal taxpayers pay for it in Washington and so on, but you got to realize that people in North and South Dakota who have no team are also subsidizing our teams. And it's not to our benefit. It's to the benefit of the team owners and players. And for a game, a sport, it's pretty bizarre.
It seems kind of a marketing problem, too. I mean, what kind of interest is there in a baseball team that doesn't win very often or draw very big crowds? There's not an awful lot of open cities in the first place,
right?
Let alone ones who want to spend.
In Minnesota, there was a good profile on the Twins case because they keep saying, oh, we're going to be out of here in no time. And I've been saying that the Pollad family, who Carl Pollad is an 80-some-year-old guy, so may not be a big thing to him, but he's got three sons, and they all have families. They're all lifelong Minnesotans. And Art Modell, when he moved the Browns out of Cleveland, he moved out too. Everybody in the community hates you. You're the villain. And I don't think the Pollads will do that. If they were to, where are they going to go? Mexico City, the players won't allow it. The league probably wouldn't allow it. Charlotte, they don't have any stadium, and it's questionable whether they can afford the team. But it's the same thing happens, and if we block it in Minnesota, it will be the first time that I know of that a legislature has blocked public financing of these things, and first time in my knowledge in Minnesota where we've stopped any of these big, well-financed projects. They bring in the big, well-funded lobbies. They hire every lobbying firm they can get their hands on, and they find a way to get it through, and corporate subsidies from taxpayers win, not because of the merits, but because they pull out all the stops, and the money really does drive the system more obviously in those situations than others. So we're about the end of the hour. I'm game to stay around because I think lunch doesn't start for 10 minutes. But
I'm curious on like campaign finance reform. Do you think it would be helpful not to allow any money by PAC? I mean, originally PACs were formed to cure.
Is a part of a reform, yeah. Stopping corporate contributions and other things. I've always been one who is very leery of pulling out some forms of big money and not others. If you take, for instance, your husband mentioned labor PAC. Labor PACs tend to have contributions from thousands of people. Most of them, some form of checkoff or something for $5 or $10 a person. Or $5 or $10 from 1,000 people, a more sinister way of raising money than one person giving $10,000 or 10 people giving $1,000. I'd say I'd rather have it come in that form, but I don't like PAC form either. And it's been a partisan thing because business versus labor tends to be a partisan sort of situation, and labor gives most of its money through PACs. Business, while it still gives about three times as much in PAC money as labor does, they also have the option of the individual big donors, executives who aren't legally allowed to be given money to give as contributions, but who may get bonuses and wink, wink, we hope you'll be generous at campaign contribution time. You could never show anything like that, but I've been very hesitant to pick and choose of which sources of big money we withdraw. And so my bill, which banned PAC contributions, it banned all contributions over $100. The Republicans and Democrats hated that, but the Republicans then said, well, how about we just ban the PAC contributions? I thought, why are those more sinister than this? The head of Cargill, the family that owns Cargill, one of the largest privately held companies in the world, is Minnesota-based, and they had one little bill on grain marketing that was passed with two or three votes in opposition in the House. I think it was unanimous in the Senate. And the governor vetoed the bill the week before he signed my campaign finance reform bill, and because it cut the limits, he took $7,000 from three members of the McMillan family that owns Cargill the week before he vetoed the bill they asked him to veto that passed almost unanimously. If some PAC had given him $7,000 made up of 10,000 people, is that good? No. Is it better that it was three individuals from the same family who did? No. I'd say they should both be banned. And I'm very leery of giving partisan advantage to one side or the other. And so.
But if you had, if you banned any PAC contributions, and if you banned, if you made a limit of, you know, whatever it is, $500 mm-hmm. or $1,000 for each person, then that would, or corporation or whatever,
right. That
would.
It, except for the fact that if you have, supposing you're some business interest that's opposed to labor, because that's a simple side where there are two sides that have lobbies and they have money and so on fighting each other. If you have the Minnesota Business Partnership is like 110 of the biggest Minnesota corporations, the CEOs of them, the business partners are 110 people, I think 109 men and one woman. And each of them could easily afford to give $1,000 to every candidate in the legislature. And if the other side, say it's a labor business issue that they're fighting on, the labor unions give, if they were able to give $1,000 to every member of the legislature, which they probably could afford to do too, then you've got an even mix. You say, okay, we're not going to allow the PAC stuff. Well, you still got these 110 people each giving $1,000 there. You've tipped the playing field that way. I think PACs are not necessarily a great thing. I don't mind people organizing for political involvement of their membership, I think, but PAC contributions to campaigns I don't like, nor do I like the big individual contributions. I think it tilts the system unfairly, and I'm not willing to do just some and not others any more than I'm willing to do just this and forget about the independent expenditures and use that as your loophole. I think we got to hit them all.
I'd like to hear your viewpoint on common cause.
Okay. Common cause, and it's been fairly weak as an organization nationally in recent years, but I've had my ups and downs with them. They're pushing for the right thing. They've been weak, and at times I haven't agreed with how they pushed for it. For instance, in Minnesota, they have their own independent, in a sense, state chapters. And when I was pushing my campaign finance reform bill, they decided, it was a little bit naive the way they decided to do it, but they brought in all the insiders to work out campaign finance reforms. They agreed on limits of $6,000 for governor. Oh, that was much tighter than it had been. I was pushing for $100. And they would not even comment in their newsletters that I had a bill. They talked about their wonderful bill that was written by lobbyists and legislators and everyone else as a compromise consensus bill. and it didn't go nearly far enough. Since then, they've had new leadership in Minnesota, and they've done wonderful things. They're pushing very aggressively for reforms that are on the mark. Nationally, there have been some changes in Common Cause. I'd say over the years, they've consistently been on the right side of things. I had one or two frustrations because I think they were shortchanging what they stood for and how well they could do it. But I've joined the organization and support it, and think that in nonpartisan group fighting for reform is there. I think they might be too shy at sometimes, but unfortunately they don't have enough clout or membership to do more. So I speak highly in favor of them. I've been frustrated by them in the past, and I'm pleased the way they're headed now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So now the big question is, when you have your own webpage, do you allow corporate sponsors on your webpage, right?
Candidates couldn't. In most states, you couldn't allow that. If you had web pages, you couldn't. Public officials or candidates could not have corporate sponsors, yeah. Uh-huh. Which is good. I mean,
I just figured there's always going to be some way that people try to get around it. So.
That's why you define gift. We define gift very broadly. There's anything of value for which you're not given equal or greater compensation for.
Okay, but can I start up a John Marty webpage myself? I support your candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I start a webpage up and get corporate sponsors and that, and this, you have nothing to do with it in the sense that
thank you.
You haven't authorized me to do it or anything, but I'm doing it because I support you.
If it is designed in any way or could be seen as helping a candidacy of mine, you would be barred from doing it, not me. You'd be barred from taking corporate contributions.
Okay.
Because it would be corporate contributions for independent expenditures. And the courts have, I think, rightly ruled that corporations don't have, the corporations themselves do not necessarily have rights to vote. They don't have rights to vote. They don't necessarily have the right to contribute to campaigns. They have not barred states from banning corporate contributions. Which is important because if you look back in history, you've seen places where employers, where you vote when you used to vote, here's the Democratic and here's the Republican box, and employers say you are expected here to vote, the polling place is at work, and we'll put it in there, you put it in the wrong box, you're fired.
Yeah.
I mean, employers have had heavy hammers over people, and I just as soon ban the contributions from the PACs and the...
Yeah.
Big donors. So, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this Washington State thing today. Yeah.